En mörk oändlig
ängmark. Welcome to Views from the World Tree. On this week's show, we don our hose, fasten our flashes, and kilt up. That's right, we're off to the Highlands for the gathering. And now, on with the show.
Yes, I see. Good news, everyone.
Cool. So for new segment this week, I actually have a bit of a reading update. I was able to make some progress on the books I've been working on. I was finally able to finish volume one of The Sandman by Neil Gaiman. I was initially wanting to finish it before I finished the Netflix show, but the Netflix show was just too good. So I finished that first and then finished the last, I don't know, four or five. I don't know, remember what they're called. They're not chapters. They're like issues or something because it's a graphic novel.
Isn't it volumes?
It must be. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think the way the audiobook does it, it's divided into acts and volumes.
Okay.
Or something like that. Anyway, so I finished that, and I did listen to the Audible version. It was just so good. so good. Audible has, with some of their recent stuff, started doing this where they have like a full voice acted, almost like an old-time radio show, with even some like background sounds and music and stuff. And that's what this was. And James McAvoy, who does the voice for Morpheus, the Lord of Dreams, just does such a good job. So definitely would recommend this one if you're interested. It also maps fairly closely to the Netflix show. There's a couple of gender swaps and really that's it. As far as the storyline, it's pretty much in lockstep the whole way. So yeah, really enjoyed that. Looking forward to moving on to the second act or volume, whatever, at some point. Hoping to first though close out some of the other books I'm working on. So
that's fair. Neil Gaiman's one of my all-time favorite actors. It's actually funny that you mentioned that you were finishing it. I saw a tweet from him today. Somebody had tagged him and said, sorry, at Neil himself, which is his Twitter handle. But he recommended going to the library and checking out Sandman from the library. And Neil Gaiman actually went on to the Twitter and quoted the tweet and said, I will never dissuade anybody from going to a public library. In fact, I donate a lot of books to public libraries. So please go enjoy my content at the public library.
Yeah, he's a really wholesome dude from what I've seen. I've never met him in person, but yeah, good guy.
I had a chance, but the autograph signing was pretty expensive at the Comic-Con that I went to that he was there. I'm like, it's not really worth it.
Yeah.
Maybe it would have been. I don't know.
So then as far as what I watched this week, I finally got around to watching Thor: Love and Thunder. It came out on Disney Plus. I want to say it's been almost a week now, or maybe it has been a week. So this one is really similar to Thor: Ragnarok. They're both directed by Taika Waititi, so they're more of that like action comedy with a lot of like witty banter and just really excellent. This one was a little bit more comedic even than Thor: Ragnarok, and some people thought that was a little bit too over the top. I thought it was great. I didn't have any problems with it whatsoever. This one really played on the whole like space opera Viking adventure trope. So it was really fun. Would definitely recommend this one. And since it's set after all of the Avengers stuff, I don't know that it really would spoil anything if you haven't watched all of that whole storyline. It kind of like stands away on its own. So it's pretty good.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't seen it. Granted, when we did our Avengers talk, you know that I haven't seen much of them. So,
yeah.
It looks good, though.
Yeah, it was my favorite. Well, not my favorite part. One of the parts I liked. So at one point, he rescues this planet from these invaders, and they give him two goats as a gift. And he hooks them up to pull his, it's not a chariot, it's like an old Viking galley ship. But when they're initially gifted to him, they're kind of like, the goats are being wild and crazy on the ship of Star-Lord and the Guardians of the Galaxy. And Thor makes the joke that, well, if we want to, we can always just kill them and eat them. Which, if you know anything about Thor's goats in Norse mythology, that was kind of a daily occurrence. So I had to laugh at that.
I like that. That is actually really clever.
Lots of little inside jokes, I guess, in this one.
There you go.
And then also there's a show on Netflix that my wife actually found and thought that I would like. So we watched it. It's called The History of Swear Words. And this is hosted by Nicolas Cage and then like a whole host of other, you know, comedians and actors and stuff. And if you're sensitive to language, I would not recommend it. But if that doesn't bother you and if you can take a joke, this was hilarious and actually very informative.
My wife and I watched that maybe 2 years ago. We got a kick out of it. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. And then as far as actual news, just a quick note, iOS 16 came out along with the Watch operating system. So I've been playing around with that. And then it's canning season, like we were talking about in the pre-show. So we've been canning peaches. We went to an orchard and picked up about 70 pounds, which is we're estimating will result in about 30, 35 quarts when it's all said and done. So we spent all night last night doing that and then part of the evening tonight. Other than that, most of the other stuff in the garden is still growing, still collecting cucumbers and tomatoes every day. Finally have some peppers that are starting to mature. So hopefully they'll finish before the frost. And then one news story that I just noticed yesterday that I thought you would be interested in. So Stanford University is working on a new technology for solar panels that they're calling optical concentrators. And basically this is an upside down pyramid shaped lens that sits on top of the photovoltaic cell. And the purpose of it is that it helps to capture and concentrate the sunlight regardless of like what angle it's coming from. So rather than having your whole solar array have to like tilt and follow the sun and all of the energy that that requires, they found that they're able to recapture most of the lost efficiency that's caused by sunlight at an indirect angle through using these optical concentrators. And they're also able to make them with an additive manufacturing process similar to 3D printing. So manufacturing them is pretty cheap as well and very scalable.
Wild. So it's like a Viking sunstone for solar panels.
Kind of, yeah.
That's yeah, kind of cool.
It literally looked like the ziggurat pyramids down in like Chichen Itza with the like step. Structure, but they just flip it upside down and stick it on the photo cell.
That sounds kind of cool. I'll have to check that out. I haven't seen that article pop up yet.
Yeah. Anyway, that was it for me. A little bit news heavy this week. How about you? What's going on?
I'm still plugging away at Ministry of the Future, the book that I was talking about last. What was it? Last week? Was that when I mentioned it?
It was either last week or the week before.
Okay. Either way, still plugging away at that one. That one is a book about the future, kind of climate catastrophe is killing off the world and people are figuring out how to handle it. But one of the interesting things that I found from this little sci-fi book is the author had mentioned because the ice shelves were dumping trapped ice into the ocean. The ocean levels were rising, so drilling companies, like oil drilling companies, with a group of scientists, were trying to figure out how to pump water out of the ocean and put them up into the highlands of Antarctica to refreeze the glaciers from the ocean levels. And it was just, it's just an interesting idea. I kind of got a kick out of that.
Kind of wild.
Yeah. I'm in chapter 50, so pretty deep into the book at this point. I think there's about 50 more chapters to go. But because in this world, this future world, Antarctica is still sitting around negative 30 degrees Celsius. The water is freezing just as fast as they're pumping it out. And so one of the characters actually flash froze into the pool while they were first testing out this technology and almost lost his life. So kind of an interesting, scary, dystopian look at our future.
Yeah. It'd be cool if it was that easy.
Right? It would be kind of neat. Another thing that they were actually talking about was because oil companies had taken so much oil out of the ground, leaving these little pools of, basically pools of water from the fracking and whatnot, that the author had theorized that in the future to battle climate change, they would recapture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, condense it into dry ice, and then pump it back down into these oil wells. So basically condensing carbon dioxide and putting it back underneath the ground as a way to capture carbon. And I thought that was kind of a cool idea too. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that most of the wells get filled in with concrete when they abandon it, but if they kept them open, then maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, I
know Switzerland and Iceland are looking at ways to capture carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the ground. I don't know enough. It's just interesting to me.
Yeah.
And to find a sci-fi book that is kind of along those lines is kind of cool.
Sure.
So. And then as far as watching, I too went on a Netflix binge. I started watching The Devil in Ohio. And I know I text you about that one. did you watch that one yet?
No. I put it on the list, but didn't have time to check it out.
Okay. Well, I'm an episode and a half in, so I'm not super far in. But basic premise, it looks like a psychiatrist that works with a hospital gets a Jane Doe to kind of open up to her. For those of you not familiar with cop mystery shows, Jane Doe is like an unidentified woman, opposite of John Doe, if you will, who was brought into the hospital with a pentagram carved into her back. And so they're trying to discover where she came from, how she was, like, who mutilated her, and all of that, and it's all linking back to this devil worshipping cult out in the middle of Amish country. And so Emily Deschanel, who is the main character in the TV series Bones, plays a psychiatrist, and she works with a detective to try and figure out how to shut this cult down. It's creepy and kind of it's fascinating, and it's just creepy enough because it's plausible. So
yeah, sounds interesting. A bit of a departure for you, as I recall you're not big into the scary stuff.
I don't like gore. I do not mind suspense.
Okay. It's like the psychological thriller type stuff.
Yeah.
More your style.
Things that make me question society is more entertaining to me than somebody who's grabbing a chainsaw and hacking random people.
Yeah, that's fair.
Granted, the Saw movies are probably some of my favorites just because they were so over the top stupid.
Yeah.
And then Cobra Kai came out on Friday, so I had to start the fifth season of that. I'm three episodes in on that, and it's shaping up to be just as good as the previous four seasons, in my opinion.
Nice.
Have you watched any of those yet, by chance?
I started it. I don't think I quite finished the first season. I have a hard time sticking with a show for whatever reason. Even the ones I really like, I lose interest pretty quick.
I will say, having hosted this podcast with you for over a year now, if you go through shows as fast as you go through books, I believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then as far as other news, nothing super exciting is going on. If you were here for the pre-show, you'll know that the owner of Patagonia just sold all of his shares to a trust that's to combat climate change. So Patagonia has gone to a public trust to basically try and solve climate change, which I thought was kind of interesting. But as far as my news, I spent the weekend up in the mountains and I learned a couple things. The first thing I learned is I do not have an untreatable cough when I'm up above the smog line. Weird, I know, but it happens. I tend to have more patients up in the mountains than I do in the city. I don't know if there's less stupid people up there or if I am just more at ease and can put up with stupidity a little bit better.
Maybe both.
And I forgot how majestic bull elk are. The rut in Colorado here starts here in a week, so all the elk are starting to move down into these mountain valleys, and you could just hear them bugling all across the valley, and those animals are so freaking cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And for our listeners that don't know what the rut is, it's basically when the biggest, baddest guys come down and try to capture a larger harem of girls to mate with, and they will bugle, and then another big bad guy will bugle back, and if he doesn't like the tone, they'll meet in the battlefields and smack heads, and then whoever wins gets to keep the girls.
Pretty much, yeah.
to put it in kind of, I don't know.
The animal kingdom is more simple than humans like to think we are. So sometimes I question that, but I think usually it's true.
Human. Yeah. But that's my news.
Cool. So on to the main topic then. Just really quickly, so our main topic obviously is Scottish Festival and Highland Games. But before we jumped into that, we just wanted to take a moment with the news this past week to talk about late Queen Elizabeth with a quick salute to her life. Might seem a little bit strange since we're talking about Scotland, but one of her favorite activities was the annual Brammer Gathering, which is a Scottish festival in Brammer, Scotland. So do you want to just talk about the Queen for a little bit?
Sure. Queen Elizabeth, born in 1926, died in 2022. She's the longest lived British monarch and the second longest lived monarch in all of the world. Some of the interesting things that I found about her: she stayed in London during the Blitz, which was the aerial assault by Germany during the Second World War. And she actually snuck out of the palace during Victory in Europe Day with her sister and mingled with the crowds and just got swept up in the celebration. She married her late husband, Prince Philip of Greece and Denmark, in 1947. They were second cousins once removed through King Christian IX of Denmark. Became queen in 1953. During her reign, something that she's most famous for is she led a lot of decolonization efforts, granting autonomy or independence to a lot of nations. She oversaw the release of Hong Kong back to China, self-governing on Belize, South Africa, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all of those. So not to get too political, but for people that see her as a colonizer, just remember she worked with the decolonizers. Just saying. She's the first Western monarch to tour a communist country when she visited the former Yugoslavia. And in Scotland, Queen of Britain, she's also Queen of the Scots. She was the patron of the Brammer Games, Brammer Gathering, which is the largest Scottish festival in the world. Her favorite event was the Caber Toss, which her and King Philip never missed, even if they did not attend any of the other parts of the games. So she always went to the caber. And we'll talk about the caber later, but for those of you that don't know, that's the iconic throwing of the telephone pole.
Yeah. Very cool. So. All right. So on to Scottish festivals then. I know you just attended one, so I'm sure you'll have plenty to share with us, which is great because I've only been a couple times and not to really any super large ones. So we just wanted to talk a little bit about what they are, what goes on at these festivals, as well as maybe some tips if you want to go and see one and you are unfamiliar. So first off, what is a Scottish festival? It is a celebration of Scottish culture and local customs from around the world. Scotland itself is home to over 200 festivals, with the happening in Edinburgh and the Brammer Gathering being two of the largest. In the US and Canada, these festivals are often a place to catch up with friends and family through the clan booths, as well as to buy unique goods from the different Celtic nations through different vendors. Most of the festivals also have competitions of some sort or another, which we'll talk about in a minute. And there are Scottish festivals where athletics, dance, band, and even rugby matches have been played and contested.
Yeah. That was a first for me. Here in Colorado, I attended one, and they had a rugby exhibition between two rival teams come up and play. It was kind of neat.
I can't say that that's ever been at any of the ones I've been to. That would be cool.
I think it all depends on size of the festival and how much space they have. Sometimes these festivals are really held in a single little baseball field, basically.
Yeah, like a park or even there's one that I went to where they shut down part of Main Street for the day.
Yeah.
not really something you want to play rugby on that hard asphalt.
Probably
or tarmac, not. Sorry, tarmac. channeling our inner Scotsman.
That's right.
Playing rugby on the tarmac.
So, yeah. So with all that going on, what is there to do? We put together some of your first steps. So when you first go to a festival, it really can be overwhelming. There's so much activity around you. There's so much noise, sounds, new smells, from the smoked haggis that either makes your mouth water or makes you retch a little bit in your, one of the two. But the first thing that I like to do is always grab a map and a schedule of the activities. This will give you an idea of what there is, what to experience, and basically where to find stuff, because each festival is different. The one that I was up to this last weekend takes place on about 100 acres of land. So if you don't know where you're going, you can get lost.
Nice. So did you get lost?
No, because I have volunteered at this festival for the last 5 years, and I've competed there 3 of the last 5 years. So I know this one pretty well. I consider this one my home festival. For those interested, I was up in Estes Park, Colorado at the Scots Irish Fest, which is the biggest festival west of the Mississippi, outside of maybe the Queen Anne Games in California. It's a pretty big one.
It's definitely the one that I've heard of the most, but that could just be a proximity thing.
Yeah.
So after you you get your map and your schedule, a couple of things that we would recommend that you check out. Firstly, I know some of the things that I like to do is check out the different clans. Most of them will have a regional representative for a Scottish laird, and will have like information, trivia about the clan, what region of Scotland they're from, and also if they have any current representation in Scottish Parliament.
Yeah. So I've worked Clan Alley, as they call it, a couple times, and I've actually had the chance to meet a couple dukes and lairds through volunteering at the festivals. Sometimes it's kind of neat to be able to say that I've met a lord that's part of British Parliament. Like, how many people can say I've met royalty that actually has a seat on a council?
Probably not many. And then if you have Scottish heritage, or you think you might have Scottish heritage and you're not really sure, you know, which of these clan booths to visit to look for your cousins, a lot of festivals will have a kind of an informational or genealogy tent where you can look up different surnames and kind of figure out who you may be related to. They'll also usually have information on which tartan your family is associated with. Tartan is the specific like pattern of plaid that is associated with that clan. It's what that clan's kilts and stuff are made out of. The good ones will also have a little bit of family history and give you a little bit more detailed look if that's kind of the thing that you're looking for.
Yeah. One thing that I can say is if you go to one of these tents and they say, oh, your last name or your mother's last name or your grandmother's last name is a sept of a certain family, that doesn't mean they're lesser. A sept just means that they were married into the family. So don't be offended if your family does not have its own tartan. If you're associated with the family, you will have a tartan. It just may not be under your name.
Yeah, and even if you don't have Scottish heritage, if you still want to participate and kind of get into that whole thing, there are tartans today that anybody is allowed, air quotes allowed. Obviously, you can do what you want, but it's considered acceptable, I guess, for anybody to participate under. So,
yeah. To add on top of that, I would say also say, as people who do not live in Scotland, you can choose whatever tartan speaks to you, except for the Royal Stuarts. Don't wear Prince, now King Charles's tartan. That won't go over very well if you go over to Scotland. But as far as the rest of them, choose the one that's cool and wear that.
Yeah. So after looking at some of the entertainment and stuff, you know, as you go and explore the rest of the festival, what are some of the places that you would suggest going to next?
After you've gone and checked out the clans, I would check out any live bands. Most festivals will have at least pipe bands, maybe marching bands. Many of the bigger ones will invite local punk artists or local folk musicians to come. If you go to Estes Park, they have 4 music stages, as well as a grandstand for with parade grounds. So you can find whatever you want. I definitely recommend checking out the music. You sometimes find some diamonds in the rough that nobody's heard of, that just can like speak to your soul. So definitely check them out.
So when you say Celtic punk, what are some examples of that that some of the listeners might be familiar with? Is that like Flogging Molly and what's the other big one?
I can't think of their name. I was listening to him the other day. Oh my gosh, I'm going to hate myself. Yes, Flogging Molly. Dropkick Murphys.
The Real Mackenzies is the one I was thinking of.
Real Mackenzies. You usually don't get them at the smaller festivals. Like Flogging Molly, I think, was an Arizona band. They've been known to show up to the Flagstaff games every now and again, but I think that's kind of off their list now. So it's going to be these smaller bands with a similar sound.
Yeah.
For sure. At the Estes Park games, and I'm going to keep going back to that since that's the one that just happened this past weekend. There's a band from Scotland that goes by the name Albanach. They're musician, like music only. They don't vocalize a lot of their songs, but they use bagpipes, violins, and then kind of pre-Christian tribal sounding drums. And so they have like real strong drum beats with like pipes and violins and fiddles and stuff. And one of the jokes with me and some of the guys that also are up there, you always know when they're on because all of a sudden the festival clears out and that music tent is packed. And another clue is they also use a didgeridoo in their songs.
Interesting. So
it's got a real primal tribal like growl to it. It's really a fun band.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
So if you were up at Estes this last weekend, their main performer, his dad passed away like the week before the festival, so they were one man down. So if you came and you listened to him and you jammed out and went, oh, they're, the energy's off, it probably was off a little bit. Just saying. That
makes sense.
So so after you check out the bands, which is always fun, my go-to is the Scottish Heavy Athletics. And I think I'm partial to this because I compete in them.
And this is what is referred to when people talk about like Highland Games, right?
Yeah. Okay. In Scotland, they have more games. It's usually met with a track and field meet as well as the heavy athletics. So they have an athletics competition and a heavy athletics. Here in America, we don't really do the track meet or the tug of war or any of that stuff. We just have big ugly brutes throwing heavy stuff.
Nice. I like it. So you talked about the caber toss earlier. I think that's probably the most well-known, throwing a tree or a telephone pole end over end. I think most listeners, that's probably what their picture of the events are. So what are some of the other events?
Before we go into the other events, there is a rich history that I did want to touch on. Okay. The Highland Games have been contested all around Scotland and in the U.S. to an extent. But back in the old days, it was a chance for the clans to elect their best warrior to go and compete in front of the regional, like the laird in front of the region, or possibly the King of Scotland himself, to prove that they're the best warrior in all of Scotland. So if you go and you look at these games and go, man, these make no sense, you have to understand that it was a proxy war. It was a way to fight a battle amongst the clans without spilling blood type of thing.
That makes sense.
So, going into it. So in the Americas, in Canada, USA, and down in South America, we have 9 events, whereas the rest of the world has 8. These 9 events, there's a stone throw. And the stone throw, you'll notice there's 2 stones that they have. The first one that you'll see is a 22-plus-pound river rock that's thrown for distance from a standing position only. This is called the Braemar Stone, which, in case you didn't gather from up above in the episode, or if you're reading the notes and following along with us as you listen to this on the podcast, the Braemar Gathering is one of the most famous gatherings, and they had a test of strength with a 23, 24, 25-pound river rock thrown for distance. The one that throws it the farthest wins. The second type of stone is a 16-ish pound river rock with some sort of approach or a way to gain momentum, whether it's a shuffle, a glide, or a spin, also thrown for distance. And this actually evolved to become the modern day shot put that you see in the Olympic Games.
Nice. As you were describing the some sort of momentum builder on approach, that was the exact image I had, is a shot putter holding the stone and doing the fancy spin and throwing it.
Mm-hmm. Because you're throwing on grass, you don't see a lot of people spinning. It's usually a glide or a shuffle, but yeah, mm-hmm. That's basically it.
Nice.
Building momentum to approach.
So I know that for the weight for distant events, there's 2 different weights to test the power of the athlete. The weights are 56 and 28 pounds for men, and they're attached to a chain that can be no more than 18 inches in length. And then these are thrown for distance. The heavy one is kind of a measure of power, and the lighter one is, it depends more on your speed and your agility, and it helps to show that. And on these, you often do see the athlete spin in order to gain momentum and then translate that into the throw. The 28-pound weight was a standard market unit of 2 stone, which is an actual like measurement of weight. Also it referred to as a quarter of a hundredweight, half a bushel. And the 56-pound weight was a standard market unit of 4 stone, or half a hundredweight, or roughly equivalent to 1 full bushel of produce.
Yep. Me and some of my friends always joke that the Scots are known to drink and have a good time. And we kind of guessed that these events probably evolved out of farmers or tradesmen waiting to weigh their produce, going, I bet I can I can throw that there marker farther than you, type of thing.
Hold my beer, laddie.
Yeah. So that's kind of the joke, is that most of these games were probably evolved from, here, hold my beer, I bet I can do something better than you, type of thing.
That makes sense.
After the Wait for Distance, there's the Scottish Hammers. And these, are, if you watch the Olympics, you might be familiar with the hammer throw. The big difference between this is and the modern hammer is the modern hammer is on a chain or a cable now, whereas the Scottish hammer is in times past it was on a rattan rod. Now we use PVC pipe because it's easier and cheaper. But the whole thing is it's a 22-pound iron weight attached to a handle, or a 16-pound iron weight attached to a handle. Again, if you're over 40 years old, over 60 years old, of the female gender, and or over 40 years old and a female, there is differences in weights. But this one is just your classic hammer throw. So you got a heavy hammer and a light hammer. The heavy hammer, actually, I digress. Both of them, you cannot spin like you see in the Olympics. You have to have your feet planted behind a wooden toe board, for lack of a better word. It's called a trig. So feet planted, and you have to build momentum by basically shifting your body weight while you're swinging it around your body. If you go to the games and you notice people walking around with work boots with daggers attached to them, those are hammer boots. They use those to kind of poke their these blades into the ground. So when the hammer is behind their head as they're coming on their upswing, it doesn't lift them out of the ground. So if you ever see that, that's what those are for.
It's interesting.
Yeah, so legend has it that this developed as a counter to the British soldiers' cannons during the Jacobite Wars, which we'll probably talk about at some point down the road. But for those of you listening now, basically, it's a time when the Scottish throne... and the English throne were under contention, and there was a Protestant trying to take over England who claimed Scotland, and Scotland was adamantly Catholic. And so you had William of Orange versus King Jacob, and there was a very bloody civil war during this time. But the Brits had cannons, the Scots did not, and so the theory has it that a 16-pound shot was picked up from the battlefields, and these farmers from Scotland attached handles to them so that they could throw them back at the British. I think it's a bunch of garbage. I think it's just a silly story, but there could be truth to it for all I know.
Yeah, stranger things have happened, right?
Right.
So similar to the Wait for Distance event, there's also an event called Wait for Height. And in this event, you basically take the 56-pound weight and you throw it up and over a height standard. And the athlete that throws at the highest wins the event. The current world record holder is a man by the name of Hafþór Björnsson, the strongman from Iceland, who you may know from Game of Thrones as the Mountain.
Yep.
Do you know off the top of your head what his record is?
Oh, geez.
Not to put you on the spot, sorry.
I can't remember. I think it's over 22, 23 feet.
Wow, that's high.
It doesn't count as an official record because he did not compete in all nine events. He only competed in the weight over the bar. So even though he has the world record, it doesn't count as a Highland Games world record.
Gotcha.
For that reason. Because in order to go into the record books and be ranked internationally, you have to compete in all events.
Cool.
That brings us to the Caber. We've hinted, this is probably the most iconic event of the games. This is what everybody sees. If you watch cartoons, this is Scrooge McDuck through Cabers sometimes in the old cartoons. You see it all over. This is the classic man in a kilt picks up a telephone pole and tries to throw it. There's some misconceptions about the Caber. The Caber, one of the biggest misconceptions is that they're throwing for distance or they're throwing for height or any of that. This is actually a finesse event. And that sounds really weird because these Cabers are 15 to 25 feet long and weigh anywhere from 50 to 200 pounds. So it takes a lot of brute strength to do them. But basically, the goal is to turn the caber or this pole so that it goes end over end and lands exactly 180 feet in front of you. You get points based on the size of the caber itself, taking into account how long it is, how much it weighs, and the taper on it. The taper being there's a thick end and a skinny end. The athlete picks it up on the skinny end, and depending on how many inches circumference it loses going down, you get more points if there's less of a taper on the caber. I did not mean to rhyme right there. Sorry.
The taper on the caber.
So the field is judged, or this is judged. The athlete will pick it up. They'll run with it to build momentum, and then they'll try to turn it end over end perfectly, and it's judged on an imaginary clock. So you'll often hear an announcer at the game say, oh, it's a perfect 12 o'clock throw. That means it landed exactly in front at 12 o'clock. And then you get slight deductions depending on how off of 12 o'clock it is. So that is the Caber in a nutshell. It's kind of hard to explain over the air. And it's just as hard to explain to people that are just watching it. But it is probably the biggest crowd pleaser just because it is such a weird, wild, stupid sport.
Nice. So the last of the nine that we have here on the list is the sheaf, or the sheaf toss, excuse me. And this event is only found in the Americas or when a North American country hosts the World Championship. And the idea of this event is to take a pitchfork and launch a 20-pound sheaf, so simulated hay bale, up and over a standard with the athlete throwing the bale the highest over the bar being pronounced the winner. Most of those who are considered the best in the world can throw the bale or the sheaf over 30 feet above the bar. My esteemed co-host averages anywhere from 20 to 26 feet, which is very impressive. And there is a theory that American athletes added this event to the games as the Scots were too good at everything else. So we invented this one to be able to beat them at something.
I think it's a sound theory, personally.
It sounds like something we would do.
But in true Scottish fashion, this one also seems like, here, hold my beer. I bet I can throw this hay up into the hayloft without having to walk it all the way up there type of thing.
Oh, yeah. I don't doubt that.
So, the sheaf toss is also my favorite event. There's a technique to it, which is kind of fun, where you really have to take your time on your windup and let gravity work with you, and you accelerate through gravity. So it's such a timing event that you really have to turn off your brain and not try to rush the natural laws of things. And I kind of like that, even though it's really frustrating when I do want to rush it.
Nice.
So we've checked out the athletics. What are some of the other things you can do? There's demonstration tents. Many of these are dependent on the festival you go to, but in my experience, there's historical reenactors that will come and reenact portions of the Jacobite uprising. You'll find people dressed up as Vikings that will come and talk about woodworking and kind of show the Viking stuff. And you might ask, what do Vikings have to do with Scotland? Well, half of Scotland was conquered by Harald Hardrade, who was the king of Norway at one time. So, like, Vikings are very much part of Scottish culture as well. They have weaving tents where they teach you how to weave the iconic tartan of Scotland, or teach you the different types of wool pools like that. There's Pictish or Renaissance style villages at some festivals where people will be reenacting aspects of history through that. You'll find military cannons. And this last one, I hadn't seen this before and I was super excited. They had a hand fasting ceremony where you could go talk to somebody and they would lead you through like this, basically a marriage type of thing where you had your hands fasted with the tartan of your clan to signify a marriage with somebody. And I thought that was really kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
My wife and I didn't have a chance to do it, but next year.
So in addition to that, there's a few things that are pretty standard. There's always various types of dance competitions, bagpiping competitions, obviously, because it wouldn't be a Scottish festival without bagpipes.
That's true.
And one of my favorite things to watch is called the tattoo, which is different than an actual tattoo like I have on my arm. But it's basically a military marching band review where different bands come, march in formation, and entertain the audience through music and precision marching. The largest and most prestigious tattoo today is the Edinburgh Tattoo at the Happening. And if you've never seen one of these, I would highly recommend looking it up on YouTube because they're very cool to watch. It's kind of like college football band like routines here in the United States, but a lot cooler in my opinion.
Oh, for sure. And if you are going to watch one, I'd definitely YouTube the Edinburgh Tattoo. For those of you that don't know what that is, type in Edinburgh
with an H on the end.
With an H on the end. They have their parade stand is surrounded by buildings. And so when the snare drummers are drumming, you get such a cool reverb off the buildings. It's phenomenal.
It's really cool. And the videos I've seen are at night, and just the way the stone walls and everything are lit up with the lights, it looks very cool.
Yes. Definitely on my bucket list of places to go. So that's what the festival is, and that is what to do at the festival. So let's talk about some tips. My first tip is if you're going to wear a kilt, try it on before you go to a festival. People can be mean, and people can be a lot meaner when they are drinking alcohol. So know how to wear your kilt. Know that the pleats go on the back, the flat side goes on the front. Definitely.
Yeah. I know sometimes there's also people that are very adamant about whether you wear it on your hips or at your waist. Because the technically the natural waist is up around your belly button or your navel. And sometimes people can get pretty opinionated. I personally prefer to wear it on my hips because that's where I wear my pants and it's more comfortable. But that's, I would say that's probably less controversial than, you know, having it on backwards or something. Would you agree with that?
Most people that I've run into don't really care. Granted, I don't know. I wear mine kind of in between my natural waist and my hips. That's where I find that it stays up the longest, especially when I'm working and running around and walking 5-6 miles in a kilt throughout the day. For some reason, I lose a little bit of belly fat during that time. I put it on later on when I get home, but during the event, it definitely starts to fall off. So that kind of happy medium between the two, I feel like keeps it on the best.
Yeah, either way, I would say a good belt is key.
Yes.
And also, just when you go, be nice to the people that are working at the festival. The vast, overwhelming majority are volunteers that do this because they love it. They're not making anything, so just try to be understanding, which is a good policy in general.
Yeah. The next one is, if you go, there's this certain type of whiskey called Scotch. It's a single malt found only in Scotland. Well, made only in Scotland, I should say. You got to understand when you go that it's expensive. And you need to plan on spending some money for a taste of this whiskey. You can't just expect free samples. You can't go up and go, oh, I want to try this. I want to try this. I want to try this. At the festival this last week that I was working at the Scotch tent. I had somebody that wanted to test before they bought a $125 dram of Scotch. And I just looked at him and I said, you can't test that unless you want to pay $125. And they went, well, how do I know if I'm going to like it? I'm like, let me put this in perspective. This bottle is a $2,000 bottle. I can't give you a test to see if maybe you will buy something of it. That's not how this works.
Yeah, it's not Baskin Robbins, which I don't know if that's even still a thing. I might be dating myself. Baskin Robbins was, maybe still is, an ice cream chain in the United States that had 31 flavors. That was their like famous thing, and they would give you free samples. So,
right. Oh, that was awesome. I'm sure they still exist somewhere.
Probably.
Well, to go back on topic, you can't ask for free samples or expect free samples at a Scotch tent, but what you can do is you can talk to the people that are working it. Most of the people there love to talk about it. They'll talk about tasting notes. They'll talk about region of where it's from. They'll talk about what to look for. They'll ask you what your go-to drink is. And they'll kind of develop an idea of what your palate is and try to match you with a Scotch that you will enjoy. They will not push the most expensive one on. They'll usually push an introductory on. If you don't know and the person there is not helpful, I would recommend choosing anything that is aged in sherry oak, as it will take a lot of the burn out and it will kind of have a sweet finish. So if you want to try it and they're not being helpful, look for something aged in sherry.
Yeah. And as far as the different regions of Scotch, I found that probably the Highland region, most people that I've talked to, that's the most approachable. The Islay region can be kind of strong for most first-time Scotch drinkers. It tends to be very smoky. So just, you know, maybe try something from kind of the Midlands or maybe the Highlands. Personally, that's what I always recommend people. It's kind of a good medium.
Up in Spey, or if you want something that's a little bit more on par with the Irish whiskeys, if you're an Irish whiskey drinker, anything from the Lowlands. So from Stirling, from Glasgow, from that area of Scotland, is also a pretty tame taste.
Yeah. And then once you've wet your whistle, one of the other fun things about these festivals is talking to people. Don't be afraid to get chatty. Go talk to people. It's all about connecting to your roots, if you have Scottish roots, or experiencing the Scottish culture if you don't. And it's kind of hard to do either if you don't open your mouth and talk to people. I say that as a self-proclaimed introvert. Talking to strangers is always really difficult for me. So, but when I do reach out and, step outside of my shell, it's really cool to meet people and exchange stories and find out that you have more in common than you thought you did. So.
For sure. Something to go on to. Do understand that a lot of these festivals are quote unquote amateur hour, like St. Patrick's Day, like Oktoberfest, like Cinco de Mayo. You will have people that do not hydrate properly. They didn't have enough to eat. They don't know how to hold their alcohol. They, whatever reasons. The festival that I was at this last weekend is at elevation. It's almost at 8,000 feet above sea level. You have people coming up from sea level or coming across the pond from Scotland to come take part in this that may not be used to being at elevation. So there's numerous reasons why somebody could get sick and pass out at the festival. My recommendations is always to have a designated driver or a designated friend that will watch your back. And just be prepared to take it slow. These festivals are an all-day thing. If you're going to go to a Scotch tasting tent, don't go grab a cask strength whiskey and slam three of them before standing in the hot sun.
Yeah, no kidding. So... and then last of all, as far as tips, just have fun. That's when you set it all aside. That's the purpose of these festivals. They're a blast. There's a ton to do. There's a lot to see. So for you, whatever it is that having fun looks like, as long as you're not, intruding on other people and making it miserable for them, you do you. Like, that's the whole purpose, is to have fun.
There you go. Well, I've got nothing else to add on festivities. You have anything you want to add before we move through?
No, I think we covered it pretty well.
Okay. I guess that brings us to our mindfulness moment. And this week's mindfulness moment... comes from an author by the name of Marie Sexton. And she said, I realized something. I realized that if I wait until I'm not scared to try new things, then I'll never get to try them at all. And I put this in because as I was thinking about the festival and writing the notes and all that, this is not something that a lot of people would go try. But it's one of the most fun events that I've ever been a part of. And I really enjoyed going out of my shell, my introverted shell, and exploring these festivals and realizing that I loved it so much that I ended up volunteering at numerous festivals. And through volunteering, realizing that I wanted to compete. And I would have had that opportunity if I didn't go experience something new to begin with. And so this mindfulness moment quote, I guess, is more a challenge to do something new. Go explore, go find something, because you'll never know what your newest passion will be if you're too afraid to go and do something.
Yeah, this, I'll be honest, this is something I struggle with. I have always been introverted, a little bit of social anxiety at times, and like stepping outside of my comfort zone and trying new things is something that has always been hard. But it's something that I've been trying to do better at. And I would agree with what you said and what the author of the quote said, that if you can just get past the fact that you're never going to not be scared to try something and just try it, then you might discover like a new favorite hobby. So it's definitely worth making yourself uncomfortable for a little bit in order to try some new things.
Excellent. I guess that ends our show.
Okay. So on next week's show, we always say that we're a variety podcast, and this is a great example of that. We are going to be taking a look at basic tools that everyone should own and how to, you know, fix household items with them.
I'm looking forward to this one.
Yeah, me too. I know a lot of people, unfortunately, didn't have somebody in their life to talk about this kind of thing with. So hopefully they will be able to offer that to somebody. All right. Well, see you next week.
See you next time. Thanks for tuning in.